Hey, it's Paul Leffler wishing you a happy St. Patrick's Day from all of us here at KMJ. It's a Saturday, so that's also Hometown Heroes Day. But it's not the luck of the Irish that this ex-prisoner of war gives the credit to.
Don't try to escape. Do what they tell you. And he says, you'll be all right. But if you try to escape, he says, they'll shoot you.
Catch this B-26 gunner's inspiring story of survival on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 or at 5 p.m. on FM 105.9 KMJ.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ, whether you catch us on the AM side at 580 at 1 p.m. or on FM 105.9 at 5 p.m. Maybe you listen online at kmjnow.com. But what you know is that each week we visit with World War II veterans. The idea is to honor them for the service, the sacrifices that they've made for our freedom. We want to preserve their stories for posterity, be entertained along the way, and also educated about what it means to really love your country. There's one kind of veteran that has been especially meaningful to me over the years. I remember growing up and seeing a license plate across the street from my grandparents' house that said POW 1930, and it took a while before I figured out that that was a prisoner of war living across the street. He was a prisoner in Stalag Luft 1 in Barth, Germany, and that's the same spot where our guest today, Lou Guernsey, spent some memorable days at the tail end of World War II. Lou joins us from Ionia, Michigan. Where were you, though, Lou, back in 1941, December 7th? Everybody seems to have a memory of that day. What do you recall about the day the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor?
Well, I was out on a farm visiting my uncle.
Uh-huh.
Well, we just went out to see him, and that's what happened that day. So I lived in Flint, Michigan at that time, and my dad, he worked at the Chevrolet automobile plant.
Did it rock your world a little bit at the time, or was it no big deal to a teenager?
Nah, not too much. We had such a war going on over there in England and stuff, you know, that it didn't. But it bothered me that we would be jumped on by a foreign country like that. Oh, yes, it did.
You would have been about 16 years old, I guess.
Yep. Right after that happened, I started sailing on the Great Lakes as a sailor, hauling iron ore from Minnesota on down to Chicago and Conneaut, Ohio and stuff, because my dad sailed quite a bit, too.
Well, I understand your dad actually went overseas with the Merchant Marine in World War II.
Yes, yeah, he did, and he was torpedoed once, and he got out of that all right. So, but my dad was an adventurer, I'll tell you. He loved things like that. So he had a lot of fun sailing. He liked it. I didn't. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to do was be a sailor.
Well, I guess that's part of the process then that led you to the Army Air Corps. How'd you end up in the Army Air Corps in World War II?
I don't know. I was drafted. I was working in a defense plant down in Detroit. In a heat treat department, I was drafted and went to the Army, and they put me in the Air Force. But I used to build airplanes when I was a kid and fly them, and I understood the rudiments of flying, and I guess maybe that's why.
Well, of all the guys I've talked to who enlisted in the Army Air Corps of their own volition, they wanted to be pilots for the most part. You, having been drafted, were you open to any assignment they had for you?
No. I told everybody that I'd seen I wanted to be a gunner.
Uh-huh. Why was that?
I don't know. I just wanted to be a gunner. Maybe I'd seen too many movies on gunners or stuff, coming in on a wing and a prayer, you know, and things like that. I don't know, but that's what I wanted to do. And I made that dream come true.
Yeah, what was that like? You said you wanted to do that from the get-go. It kind of sounds like you had a natural inclination and ability there. Were there some tough moments along the way to figure that out and actually get assigned?
No. After we went through gunnery school, in fact, some of the guys weren't too good at shots at the gunnery school, so I would shoot for them so they could get their scores up. I was a natural gunner, I guess. After we got in our airplane and we started flying over the Gulf of Mexico, they'd have gunnery practice down there. They would throw out ammunition boxes, and I could shoot those boxes all apart as they was falling with my tail guns. My crew loved that. They thought they were completely safe in back because I could shoot like that.
Well, I guess so, and I want to ask you about something you said there. You talked about other gunners having you shoot for them to get their scores up. How'd you pull that off? Well, you got up in the air, and they were supposed to be at the gun, and you took over, or what are you saying there?
Yes. I did that with shotguns, too.
I don't think anyone's ever told me a story.
I used to shoot every chance I got.
Uh-huh.
Down in the gunnery school, they had an arcade game that you could shoot machine guns at airplanes flying across the ceiling of this thing. It was a big concave ceiling. And I used to lay in that thing by the hour and play with it. I loved it. You know, I like flying. In fact, I'm a commercial pilot now.
At age 87.
Yeah. Let's back up. That's on sailplanes.
All right.
I was ready to solo in power planes, but I didn't want a divorce because I knew if I got my power license, I'd want to buy an airplane. So I told the guys, no, I quit right now. And I worked at the airport for about 25 years part-time, mowing and flying. I've been up in a sailplane over 500 times, I think. Love flying. My kids love it, and so does my wife. Well, my wife used to sit in the back seat when I was flying taking power lessons. Of course, we was all from the airport, and the guys had better sit back there. We shoot landings with my wife in the back seat. She loved it.
Well, I understand she's traversed a few roads on a motorcycle with you, too. But speaking of, I asked you about getting into the Army Air Corps, but you mentioned being married. And the story here starts before you went overseas for World War II. Now you had this lovely lady in your life. When did you meet Ann, and when did you know that she was going to be your wife someday?
Well, I come home on furlough, and my stepmother had moved. And so I come up to the house, and I was in there changing my shirt. I remember I'd had my shirt on 3 or 4 days, and I was changing it. My sister said, Lou, she says, there's Anna Lee out there. Should I call her in? And I figured a girl about 10 or 12 years old was coming in, and I said, yes. And in come Anna Lee, and she was a little doll, but she was 16 at the time. She had on a big red apron, and I'll never forget that, and her face got red, and she went right back outside, and I went right out after her. And we started dating while I was on this furlough, and I knew the third time that I went out with her, I was going to marry her.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't tell her that because I didn't want to scare her off. She was still going to school. And, of course, I was 18 at the time, you know, or 19, but I knew it. I had to have her for a wife. She's something. And we've been married 66 years.
Well, and you said you knew she was going to be your wife, but the catch there was you would have to survive a war and survive being a prisoner of war to make it back to marry her. But when you went overseas, you took something to remind you of her, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. I had a picture in a little leather pad that I used to put in my jacket all the time when I flew.
Mm-hmm.
And I had that, and I still got that picture here. It was on me when I got shot down.
And we're going to get to that. But I want to, before we get to your 32nd and final mission with the 394th Bomb Group, the 586th Bomb Squadron, I want to talk about your first taste of this plane that has been much maligned in history. Now, and when most people think of bombers in World War II, they automatically go to B-17s, B-24s, and B-29s. But you flew another bomber, the B-26 Marauder, which some people said was a murderer, not a marauder. They called it the Flying Coffin, all kinds of awful names for it. One a day in Tampa Bay as you trained down there at MacDill Field in Florida. Was it really as bad as all those nicknames suggest?
Well, it was. due to the fact it was a hot rod.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's somebody like flying. I'll say you was driving a Model A Ford, and then all of a sudden somebody put you in a hot rod and told you to go out in the street, and the first thing you're going to do is wreck it because you don't know how to handle it.
All right.
After the people got to learn how to fly the things, they were a great, great airplane. In fact, they had the lowest loss ratio due to enemy action of any airplane in the Air Force. Now, that's quite a pipeful, but that's what happened, really.
Mm-hmm. So you came to appreciate this plane, the B-26.
It was the speed. We were fast. The Germans normally didn't jump it too much with their aircraft because it was so fast. We had 12 machine guns on that thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the Germans treated us pretty much, I think, with respect. In fact, I flew 32 missions, and I only shot at one German airplane, and that was a rocket plane going straight up. And it was through frustration that I shot at him, because I used to sit there and they'd shoot at us with anti-aircraft. There was nothing I could do but sit there and take it, you know. And,
mm-hmm.
But when German aircraft come in and started shooting at you, you knew somebody was going down. You knew that. The Germans, they were good fighters. Don't underestimate those guys. They were good.
No doubt about it. And their technology at that point was certainly superior. You referenced a rocket plane. I'm guessing you meant the ME-262, the first jet fighter, right?
That's what it was, yeah. And if Hitler hadn't have invaded Russia, we'd still been fighting that war over there, I think.
Well, thank the Lord.
It was terrible.
Now, I want to ask you about some of your missions, but just out of curiosity, the B-26, give us a picture of what that crew was like, how many guys were on the crew, and were you jealous that you didn't get to be a nose gunner on that plane? Because the nose gunner had a pretty great view of everything in that see-through plexiglass nose of that plane.
No. I wanted to be a tail gunner. I went through the war seeing where I'd been instead of where I was going, because I rode backwards.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a good view of everything in back, and if I could watch the bombs go down, I could see what they hit, and it was interesting back there. I was all by myself. There was a six-man crew on a B-26.
Mm-hmm.
There was the first guy, like you said, was a bombardier. Then there was a pilot and a co-pilot, a top turret gunner. He was the engineer. Then there was a radio man, and he was a waist gunner. And then there was myself. I was the armor. I was a tail gunner.
Mm-hmm.
And I would check the bombs after they were loaded, make sure they were fused right, and check the guns on the airplane. That was my job, plus being a tail gunner.
Do you remember what your first mission was like, and do you remember feeling a little anxiety going into it?
Well, the first mission was a great adventure. I thought, man, this is great. You know, I really loved it. We went on a milk run. A milk run is where there's no anti-aircraft. And we were bombing a warehouse, and we didn't drop bombs. We come back because of the clouds. So the second mission was the same thing, but we dropped bombs that time. Then on my third mission, it was over Metz, France, and we went in 6,000 feet. And I thought, man, this is great, you know. Look at that. There was 20 millimeters coming up from the Germans, and I was looking at them, you know, and I didn't think much of them. Then on the fourth mission, the airplane next to us exploded, and I said, I don't like this anymore, you know. And then from then on, when I seen heavy anti-aircraft, it was terrifying to sit there, you know, and couldn't do nothing, just scared. I didn't say nothing to nobody, but I'll tell you, I was plenty scared back there. If anybody says they were flying in an airplane and they were shooting at that aircraft, you could hear it, you could smell it, and you knew what it was. It was bad.
When those moments came, when you felt that fear come on, did you find any way to deal with it and to end up focusing again? I mean, did you sneak a peek at Ann's picture inside your coat? Were you a praying man? How did you get through those moments?
Oh, yeah, I used to pray back there. I wasn't saved at that time. I am now. We'd sit back there, and you couldn't smoke because if you lit up a cigarette, you got a leak in the gas tank or something, you know, and there was gas fumes in there, the whole plane would explode.
Mm-hmm.
So you just sat back there and hope that you got through it all right. Sometimes you'd look ahead of the airplane, you'd see flak up there. The Germans put what they'd call a wall of flak up, and you had to fly through it.
Yeah, you can't try to avoid it because you're in
formation.
No, you're
on a bomb run and everything, and you have to fly straight and level for 3 or 4 minutes while they go from the IP to the dropping, you know, where they drop them, and it was terrifying. And everybody had that. The Germans never, they couldn't understand, they could not turn back an American flight airplanes. The guys would fly through the stuff. They knew somebody was going to get hurt, but they still did it.
I can't imagine being in your shoes in a situation like that, knowing what's coming and just bracing for impact. I'm curious, during this time, were you able to form a pretty good bond with the members of your crew and actually keep that crew together for most of these missions?
Yes. Well, we trained down in Shreveport, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a good camaraderie. In fact, the top turret man, he was in the same prison camp with me. He was my best man when I got married. Mm. Then I went over to Wisconsin and seen the other gunner, Reuben Harchie. He was the radio man. But I'm the last man of the crew that's alive right now. When we got shot down, there were six of us in the airplane, and three were killed and three of us got out.
And your families didn't know whether or not you'd been killed for quite some time. We're going to get to all of that. Right now we need to take our first commercial break, but when we come back, we'll hear more about Lou Guernsey's 32 missions on B-26s during World War II with the 394th Bomb Group. We'll hear about that final mission when he was shot down, about his time in captivity, and even some of the adventures he's up to today at age 87. Hometown Heroes will be right back after a word from one of our sponsors here on KMJ.
It's as simple as ABC, friends, no T.
I can remember hearing that jingle on the radio for years, but I didn't really understand what it meant until redoing my shower a couple years ago. This is Paul Leffler, proud to welcome Fresno Distributing as a sponsor of Hometown Heroes here on KMJ. The knucklehead who tiled my shower, that would be yours truly, left a decent-sized hole around the shower arm. I needed an oversized flange to cover it, and I went all over town. None of the chain stores had what I needed. Finally, a merciful soul asked me, "Have you tried Fresno D?" Fresno D, as in duh, why didn't I think of that in the first place? So I quickly took the 41 of the McKinley exit, walked into Fresno Distributing, and bumped smack dab into the owner, Steve Cloud. He said he was sure they had exactly what I needed, and of course, he was right. Now I make Fresno D my first stop, whether I'm looking for one of those obscure plumbing parts or a top-of-the-line appliance, like the new Electrolux energy-efficient washer and dryer set my wife picked out. They have all the other top brands, too. Don't make the mistake I did. If you want your first stop to be your last stop, make a beeline for Fresno D. And while you're there, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes on KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
You recognize the instrument, but do you know who is picking those strings on the banjo? That is none other than our guest today, 87-year-old Lou Guernsey of Ionia, Michigan. When did you start playing the banjo, Lou?
When I was 48 years old.
Uh-huh. So you've only been playing
it. I went to church one day, and there was two guys in church. Two of my friends were playing banjo. I didn't even know they played banjos. They had such a good time up there in the church playing the banjo. I told my wife while they were doing it, I said, "I'm going to do that." So I ended up 3 months later, I was up there playing with them. So I had a lot of fun.
And you still do it quite a bit, don't you?
Well, every Thursday night, I have a jam here in Ionia. 16 years ago, I started a jam, and I thought, now, if this thing runs 6 months, I'll be lucky. And it's been 16 and a half years now. And it's just as big as it was then. And I have people that come every Thursday night that's their night out.
Uh-huh.
So they go listen to the music. And I went for a lesson today, and we cut 11 songs on a CD. So I have a good time.
I guess so. Well, we're going to go back to a time that maybe wasn't quite so carefree for you during World War II. You're a young airman on a B-26 crew with the 394th Bomb Group, the 586th Bomb Squadron. March of 1945 is rolling around. You guys have been bombing targets in Germany. And do I have this right? You find out you're going to have a different pilot or a co-pilot that day?
Well, they would take the first pilots of new crews and have them fly a mission or two with crews that were experienced.
Mm-hmm.
So they would fly as a co-pilot, and they could see what was going on. And then when they had their own crew, they would be acclimated a little bit. So this Robert Turner, he was a pilot for the first pilot on another crew. So he was going to fly with us. We were one of the experienced, probably had 30 missions in or better. I mean, and so we were experienced, and he was going to fly with us. And this is his first mission. He got killed. It's bad, but he did. And the thing that hurt, when his father heard that he was killed, he went down the basement and hung it up.
Mm.
Now, can you imagine that mother and that wife losing both a son and a husband?
Horrible.
But that was bad on that man's part, because he lost his son, that he'd go hang it up, but he did.
Oh, war is an ugly thing. And, tragedies are left and right. What do you remember about that day? And I guess the plane you were in was called Sheboygan Redskin?
Yeah, the Sheboygan Redskin. Well, that was the first airplane that we flew a mission in.
Uh-huh.
Then after that, we got our own airplane. It was called Who Cares? And it had a big question mark on the side, and there was a hillbilly sitting on a stump with a jug of Mountain Dew and a muzzle-loading rifle. And he's sitting on the side of that, and that was our airplane. Well, our aircraft that day was in getting a 50-hour checkover, and so we went back in the Sheboygan Redskin. And while I was flying in it, I was looking. There was a hole down there in that that had been passed. In about, say, 6 or 8 missions before that, the tail gunner in that aircraft was sitting there, and a piece of flak went up through there and went through his eye and killed him.
Mm.
Went right through his eye and up into his brain. And it was, I don't know, I'd sit there and look at that hole, and I hope it didn't happen to me.
Yeah, you're sitting in the very same spot that he had been sitting in.
But we used to go look at the bulletin board in there and to find out if he's going to fly. And when the guys would say, well, I live another day, I don't have to fly tomorrow. But when the Battle of the Bulge came on, that was bad. We was flying 2 missions a day up there helping the guys in the Battle of the Bulge.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I got shot down that day, too. But,
well, maybe we should hear that story before we get to when you were shot
down.
Well,
no, that's we had intense accurate flak that day,
mm-hmm.
and it was bad. And there was thousands of airplanes in the sky. It was, I never seen anything like it. You know, they were dropping paratroopers over there and supplies and parachutes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was C-47s flying, and then there was B-26s. There was B-17s up above us, and they shot down 2 of those while I was sat there. I seen 2 of those go down. Just as we turned on evasive action, 2 88s went off right where our aircraft would have been.
Oh, man.
If we hadn't turned, and that was close.
I could see that getting your attention a little bit.
Oh, yeah. And then when I got back, the hub on our right engine was kind of off-center. So I went over, and I looked in the engine nacelle, and I picked out a piece of an 88 shell that weighed about 0.5 pounds. And I had that as a souvenir, but when I got shot down, somebody took it. And I don't know where it went.
Well, and I'm glad that you bring that up with that engine being damaged, because a lot of times when we talk to guys who are on bomber crews on this program, they were on a B-17 or a B-24, planes that had 4 engines. You didn't have that luxury. If you lose an engine, that's half your ability to stay in the air right there.
Well, they would fly on one engine, but it took a good pilot to fly it on one engine. Mm-hmm. And Arnold, who died on the way to the hospital, German hospital, he was a good pilot. And he's buried in Ohio now, down in Columbus, Ohio. I found out where he's buried. A while back, I got an email from a guy in Holland, the old country over there. He wanted to know about that mission. So I told him about it, wrote him an email. They had adopted Turner. According to him, they haven't found Turner, who flew his co-pilot for us that day. But he was buried right next to the aircraft. The way I understand, our regular co-pilot went up there that day to see what happened. And he found the wreck the wreckage, but the Germans had buried the airplane in the ground.
Wow.
Now, why they did that, I don't know, but the airplane was buried right out in this farmer's field.
Huh.
They were doing some funny things, I guess, toward the end of the war.
Well, you survive those bomb runs during the Battle of the Bulge, which I'm sure that's the last kind of situation where you'd want to be ditching an airplane is in that kind of wintry mess.
Well, at the Battle of the Bulge, everybody wanted to fly and get up there and help those guys.
Oh, I bet.
We all knew that.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on up there, you know? The weather was so bad we couldn't fly, but boy, when that broke, everybody wanted to go. Well, on the 22nd of March, we were told to bomb Halturn, Germany, right on the outskirts. Every town in Germany was built on a four corners, it seemed like, and there was these two main roads up there, so we were to bomb that intersection and also into the town as a fortified town. Well, we went in, dropped bombs, and we just dropped the bombs, and the bomb bay doors closed, and all of a sudden, I was looking at the airplane next to us, and our airplane shook, and the one next to us, the tail guns got shot right out of that gun, that airplane. They made a whip, and they went down, and I thought, boy, them guys are going down, and then over the intercom come bailout men. When you're in the crew and somebody says something like bailout men, you bail out. You don't say why. You don't say, well, I wonder what happened. You got out because I had seen so many airplanes explode in the air, you know, and nobody get out of them.
Mm-hmm.
That my first thought was, man, I'm going to get out of this thing. It's a flying bomb, you know. So I backed off my seat and took my, we had a little suit, a vest-like thing we had on. It was called a flak vest, and I took that off. I got my parachute and snapped it on and went over to the waist window, and my gunner there, he pointed out, so I went out. I was the first one out of the airplane. And I come down, and as I was coming down in that parachute, I'm coming down right on the edge of the town we just bombed. Now, if that don't raise the hair on the back of your neck, I'll be surprised because we did this, and it was about 50 or 60 fires down there.
And you were the ones responsible for
yeah.
it. Yeah,
we did it, you know, and I'm coming down, and the closer I get to the ground, I'm about 200, maybe 250 feet off the ground. I look down, and here's a German soldier with a rifle pointed at me. And I, that's what I need. Well, I took my hands off the shroud line and showed him I didn't have nothing. He put his rifle down, and I grabbed the shroud lines, and by then I hit the ground, and I thought they'd shot me because my back hurt. I hit backwards. I was swinging pretty heavy, and well, I jumped up, took my parachute off, and I looked up, and here come four or five German soldiers running toward me. Well, I just stood there. I don't know what happened to me. I'm not a brave man. I wouldn't put my hands up. I said to myself, I'm an American soldier, and I'm a sergeant in the United States Army. I'm not going to put my hand up, and I'm not going to say comrade. I just stood there. Well, this German sergeant come up to me, and he unzipped my jacket, and he reached in there, and I had a holster 45 pistol in there, and he took that, and he says, I'll take this. And he says, empty your pockets. And he could talk a little English, or good enough English to tell me that. So I had this picture of Anna Lee, and I give him that. I give him my escape kits, and I had two more clips of ammunition for that 45. Now, why I carried it, I don't know, but I did. I give him that. I had a package of Camel cigarettes in my pocket that I hadn't opened. I always flew with a new package of cigarettes and some matches. I had a jackknife in my pocket, and they took that. They give me the cigarettes back, and they give me my matches back. And that picture of my wife, Anna Lee, because she was my girlfriend then.
Right.
Then they patted me down to make sure I didn't have a pistol hit on me or something. Then they said, come this way, get your parachute. So I picked the parachute up, and we walked off. Well, I went over, maybe went about a mile. On the way over there, there was a bunch of kids, about 14, 15 years old, following along. You know, they thought this was like, they had a big time, laughing at me and stuff. And there was one little girl there. She must have been about 15 or 16, and I looked at her, and I thought of Anne. And but this girl had on a pair of bib overalls. Now, why that sticks in my mind, I don't know. But anyway, we went over, and they took me back, and there was a bunch of soldiers by some two-man tents. And these guys were cleaning ammunition and putting it in machine gun belts. And they says, are you hurt? And I said, well, my back hurts. And they said, well, we got a doctor coming. I said, oh, that's not necessary. Well, he's coming. So up drove a car, and out come a German doctor. And he was a German officer of some kind. I don't know what his rank was. And he asked me if I was hurt, and I told him my back hurt. And he said, well, there's nothing we can do about that. And he said, how bad was Chicago bombed? I said, no, Chicago hasn't been bombed. Well, he says, I was a doctor in Chicago for 8 years.
Wow.
I had a very good practice buildup. And he says, I went home to the old country to see my parents, and they constructed me in the Army. And he says, here I am. So we talked for a little while about different things, nothing military, just, and he was a nice guy. I wish I'd have got his name. And he asked me, he says, are you hungry? And I said, yes, I'm kind of hungry. This is about, 12 o'clock in the morning, 11:30, 12 o'clock. I didn't know what time it was because they'd taken my wristwatch. And he said, I'll get you something to eat. So he spoke to one of these Germans, and he went away, and then he asked me if I wanted some beer. And I said, well, I'm kind of thirsty. So they poured some beer out of a pitcher they had there. And he says, here. And he gave me that. I says, I thought, I tasted it. It was horrible. I said, I thought you Germans made good beer. I said, this is not good. And he says, no. He said, that's enlisted man's beer. He says, I'll get you some good beer. So he said something to another guy, and he went. And pretty soon this guy came back with sandwiches, and the doctor said, well, I've got to go now. He says, don't try to escape. Do what they tell you. And he says, you'll be all right. But if you try to escape, he says, they'll shoot you. He says, do as they tell you. He says, you'll be okay. For you, he says, the war's all over. He says, just be mindful of that. So I was. Well, anyway, this guy come up with these sandwiches, two sandwiches, and they had that black bread that the Germans was eating. But there was some delicious salami on there. Oh, is that good. Then this another guy come up, and he handed me this big old bottle of beer. And so I opened that beer up, and I drank it, and it tasted so good. I was thirsty, and I'm telling you, I was scared. When I come down in that parachute, I was terrified. I'd heard some bad stories about what they did to airmen.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, I drank this beer, ate them sandwiches, and then it hit me. And I thought, they put something in that beer, so I would start talking to him. So there was a little tree right there, and it was kind of a warm day that day. So I sat down on the ground, put my back to that tree, and I actually went to sleep. Too much beer, I'll tell you. I'm not a beer drinker. I don't drink, you know. But anyway, that beer was awful strong. Then I woke, I heard the awfulest explosions, so it woke me up, and I was in this anti-aircraft outfit, and they were shooting at some B-26s going over. And it was bad. They were putting them shells right in there, you know, and these guys were good. Of course, they'd been shooting at airplanes for 5 or 6 years, you know, and they knew what they were doing.
They were experienced. And you knew, having been on a B-26 crew, that you guys would often bomb places just like that before you'd bomb your target, so you'd have
That's
a chance
right.
of getting through.
We'd send three airplanes ahead, and they would bomb known anti-aircraft positions. Then I thought to myself, man, I hope they don't bomb this one until I get out of here. Well, anyway, they come, got me in a car, and took me around. We went by a pasture field, probably about 10 or 15 acres, and there was a beautiful herd of cattle in it. And some of them were standing there with their insides hanging out, some with broken legs, some were on the ground, and there was people there butchering them. And the guy in the car, he says to me, he says, you did that. You did that. And we did do it, you know, kill them beautiful cows. Then they took me to for interrogation. And this is another time I got a little bit upset. They had this little German soldier there, a lieutenant. And I walked in the door, and there was a civilian there, and he came over and took my cigarettes. And I had two cigarettes left out of that package. Because I was lighting the cigarettes and smoking down about a quarter of an inch and putting them out and putting them in different pockets. Well, that didn't go good. I didn't salute that bugger, you know. But I did. I gave him a half a salute. Then he set me down and started asking me questions. He wanted to know how many missions I'd flew, and I told him it was my first one. And he asked me that about three times, and I tell him that's my first mission. Well, he walked over and he unzipped my jacket, and he says, now your jacket, there's your serial number. You got a new jacket when you come over here. And he says, look at this jacket. It's all tore. It's got the little spots on it. three-cornered tears, because you walk through an airplane, there's always something catching. And he says, it's greasy, it's dirty, and he says, you flew more than one mission. No, one mission. I wouldn't tell him any difference. The heck with him.
Even though you'd flown 32.
Yeah, I wasn't going to tell him.
Right.
He drew two airplanes, and he put a cable between them, kind of back at a V, and he drew a box at the apex of that V, and he says, now, what was that that they were towing? I says, I don't know what it is. He says, you're an American sergeant? He says, you're not stupid. He says, what was that? I says, I don't know what it was. He says, yes, you do. Well, I says, if you really want to know, and boy, he looked right at me, he hunched right up and got over that picture. I said, this tail gunner over here did his washing. He had it out there to dry. I shouldn't have done it. I should not have done that. He jumped up. His face got red, and he pointed at a window. He says, you see that window? And I says, yes. He said, he was screaming this. Now, he's not, he is mad. He says, I'll take you out there and shoot you. You think I can't shoot you? He says, I can call these men and they will take you out there and shoot you. I can shoot you anytime I want to shoot you. Nobody will know the difference, but I'll take you out there and shoot you. Man, I thought to myself, well, you idiot, you've stuck your mouth, your foot in your mouth this time. You've got to shut up to these Germans. Don't try to get them. No sense of humor. Well, I cooled him down a little bit, but... And then I got out of there. Man, I tell you, I thought I'd had it. We went to a barn, big horse barn. It was all cleaned out nice, and straw all over, picnic tables in the middle. And they put me in the corner of this horse barn, and it was cold. They'd taken my flying suit and stuff. All I had was a jacket and pants, regular army pants, and... I laid there, and somebody threw a greatcoat over me. Now, them Germans had them big overcoats, and they'd throwed one of them over me, and boy, that felt good. Well, that was an act of kindness. That was the second act. The first act is when I got that beer and them sandwiches. This was the second act. Then in the morning, when I woke up, there was a young soldier sitting on one of them picnic tables. He called me down, give me a slice of bread. He reached in a knapsack, and he took out a can of strawberries jammed, and he had maybe about 2 inches of it left, and he put some on the bread and he handed it to me, and he let me know that his mother had made him that jam, and he'd give me some. Well, I felt kind of privileged eating that. You know, that was the last act of kindness I got till I got to prison camp. That was it. No,
probably
more
probably the last decent food you ate for a while too.
Well,
huh?
Then I went outside, stood out there, and by a car. They were going to take me away in a car. And, some sergeant walked up, and he pulled a P-38 pistol. He stuck it in about 10 inches from my belly, and started calling me every name he could lay his tongue to. S-O-B, murderer, baby killer. And I kept smiling at him. I didn't know what to do. I thought, that's fool, he could shoot me, you know, but I smiled at him. Pretty soon he quit, and he put his pistol, and he started to walk away, and I thought, now I got to get you somehow. So I reached out to shake hands with him, and he started to shake hands with me, and then he realized what he was doing, and he threw my hand down, and I says, yeah, I gotcha. It made me feel good. Boy, that really ticked him off, and he walked away. I don't know, I had a ring also that my granddad had given me. It was a gold ring and had a big set in it. It was aquamarine. It was a beautiful ring. They hadn't taken it yet, so I put it on my dog tag chain, and they looked at my dog tags. They'd always look at the top one, and I put this on the bottom one, and I give that ring back to my granddad when the war was over. Boy, was he happy. But the Germans never seen it, and that made me feel good that I put that over on them, too. We went to the prison camp, and the Russians liberated it. And once you got to the prison camp, they left you pretty much alone. You had to stand count every morning, or they might have an emergency count, and you always had to have your dog tag in your pocket. You had the Germans give you a dog tag, and my dog tag number was 8126, and every prisoner there was known as Kriggy.
Mm-hmm.
You never knew what a guy's name was very much. You said a little bit ago, you know, that you didn't know guys' names.
Well, yeah, that... of the seven or eight, maybe even more veterans that I've interviewed, all from that same prison camp where they had, you know, 10,000 men. None of them have ever known each other in captivity, and you can see why.
No, it was just a kriggy.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. I had a strange thing happen to me. I was in Lansing one day, and I've got a license plate. It says kriggy. That's my license plate on my van. The one on my truck says I was an ex-POW, but a lady walked up to me and she says, "Was you in the war?" And I says, "Yes." She says, "Was you in prison camp?" "Yes." Well, her granddad was in Stalag Lift 1.
Huh.
And he'd been in there about a year and a half. He had an attack of appendicitis, and they operated on him with a razor blade without any antiseptic of any kind, no beer, no nothing. The guys held him down. They cut him open, took his appendix out, and sewed him back up. Because they was talking about scars one day, and he says, "You people haven't seen a scar in his family, you know." And he said, "Look at this." And they showed him that. But can you imagine that?
He'd have died
if he hadn't have done that. But to hold a guy down and take his appendix out without anything. But now, well, I'm getting off my story.
Well, I'm glad you got there, though, because if there's one thing that stands out to me from all the prisoners of war that I've interviewed, I try to put myself in your shoes, and I say, well, how in the world would I deal with the uncertainty of the situation, not knowing if you're ever going to be free again, let alone when you might be free, but also the ingenuity that seemed to come up in so many guys. You just hit on one point, the impromptu appendectomy there, but the guys I've talked to found all kinds of different ways to make things that I would have never thought of. Did you do anything like that?
Yeah. After the Russians liberated the prison camp, I built myself a little hut outside, right outside, and I put straw in it to sleep on. I had slept on a wooden floor, and I was 6'1", weighed 145 pounds, and my hip bones were so sore.
Mm.
From laying on that floor. But I'll tell you something that was kind of comical. Now, these guys are all young. Most of them are under 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been locked up, and they got to do something. And when the Russians came, they told us to knock down the fences and stuff. So I took a searchlight, and I built an oven, and I made a stove, and I put a smokestack on it to where I could cook stuff. And that searchlight I made as an oven, and I could put a chicken in there and roast it. And the guys would come to me and they'd say, "Well, we want to roast our chicken." "Okay, but I get the wings and the legs." That was my cut for using my stove. So I was eating pretty good.
At that point, yeah, I guess so. Well, I'm sure there are more stories where that came from, and we'll get to those when we continue with Lou Guernsey right after another message about our supporters of Hometown Heroes like Fresno Distributing. What do you think of when I say Fresno D? Probably that catchy little jingle, right?
It's as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Paul Leffler here to tell you what it means to me. It means Fresno Distributing selection of top-of-the-line appliances at wholesale prices for you, me, and everybody means you don't have to go anywhere else. Since I started hosting Bulldog Coaches shows in Fresno D's showroom a few years back, I've gotten to know the owner, Steve Cloud, quite well. I know that some of his favorites are King Tut, Coca-Cola with real sugar in it, and of course the Bulldogs. I know not to challenge him in gin rummy because he's a former world champion, no joke. But the other thing I know, and here's why my wife and I picked out our new Electrolux washer and dryer there, I know the Cloud family has been carrying the best appliances you can find anywhere since 1946. Bosch, Frigidaire, Maytag, Jennair, KitchenAid, Wolf, you name it. They have it. Don't just take my word for it. Go see for yourself at Fresno Distributing on McKinley between Blackstone and 41. Plumbing, lighting, electrical, kitchen, bath, whatever you need, Fresno D has it. And you won't find friendlier or more knowledgeable service anywhere. A locally owned business with great prices, great selection, and great service. Why go anywhere else? Still as simple as ABC, Fresno D.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while. So next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Remember, if you ever want to see what the guests on this show look like, all you need to do is go to kmjnow.com and click on Hometown Heroes, or you can check out Hometown Heroes on Facebook. You can go see what Lou Guernsey looked like in World War II. Now let's hear some more of his stories from Stalag Luft One, where he spent the last couple months of the war in Europe.
The Germans used to take the fur collars off our flying suits, mm-hmm. or, you know, it's jackets. They were a mouton fur, artificial, you know, made.
Synthetic fur.
But anyway, yeah. I don't know why they took them, but they had a whole lot of them. So some of the guys got them, and they built an outhouse, and they lined that outhouse with them fur collars, inside and out, the door, the ceiling, the floor, the seat. And I'm going to tell you, I use a fur-lined outhouse. Now, you've heard about them, but I actually used one.
In a prisoner of war camp, like,
yeah.
of all places.
Yeah. These guys, I tell you, they just had to do something. They'd been boxed up so long. The Russians brought in 150 cows, and they were Holstein cows, beautiful cows, for us to eat. So there's guys in there that had done everything, you know. So some of them went down and started butchering these cows. And I grabbed a pitcher that we had for water, and I told the guys, I said, I'm going down and get some milk. Somebody come on and hold these cows. Well, so a couple of guys went there, and they'd hold the cows, and I'd milk them. Because I'd been on a farm, I knew how to milk cows. But I went back with this beautiful milk. Some of the guys wouldn't drink it because it wasn't pasteurized. I drank it. It was great. Then we was in the camp about 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks after the Russians came, before the Americans brought in airplanes to fly us out. The Russians wanted to march us back into Russia. No way. Oh, and one other thing. Hitler, before he killed himself, gave an order to the prison camps to shoot all the American and English airmen.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody did. Jesus, wouldn't that have been horrible?
Mm. We wouldn't be talking right now, that's for
sure. No, well, that, but I mean, just think of the slaughter it would have been. You know,
thousands and thousands.
They knew better.
Well,
Hitler, he went out of his rocker anyway at the end. And
you mentioned what the Russians wanted to do with you, and what I've understood from other prisoners who were at Stalag Luft I is that the reason the Russians didn't was because a courageous ace of a P-47 pilot, Colonel Hub Zemke, negotiated a different outcome, right?
That's right. Zemke, he wouldn't let him take us away. But you know, the Russians... The average Russian that I saw, he was just like us, you know. He wanted to get the war over and go home.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no problem with the Russians. I went into town, walked around, seen them. And all their women, they all had a great big pistol on their rump, so you didn't bother none of the Russian girls. And I don't think the Russian men would have liked it if you had them. But the Russians hated the Germans because they'd killed so many Russians.
Sure. You know, I want to get to what it felt like to be free again. But before we go there, I know you weren't in the POW camp for as long as some of those other fellas that you were there with. I guess you were there not quite 2 months. But what was the biggest challenge for you? What was the hardest thing to deal with? And did you have some nights where, you know, you really felt desperate or hopeless?
No, No. The biggest thing to deal with was the lack of food. There was always that constant hunger. And that was the big thing. To me, I knew the war was about over. And once I got in, well, I felt kind of secure in the prison camp. It was getting there that was bad. One night they put me in a room that was lined with hardware cloth. It was a post office. And I think the whole people come in there, the whole town, and looked at me, you know. And a lot of them said things to me that I didn't know what they were saying because they were talking in German, but it wasn't nice. And they were the ones that was giving you the problems. I remember one night we stopped outside of a beer joint. Beer garden, pub, or whatever you want to call them over there, and a bunch of German soldiers was in there. You could hear the music going on in there and everything, and the laughter and the camaraderie they were having. Some of them come out, and it was bad that they called us everything, you know. And there was one soldier there that had a suit on. Oh, he was pressed, and he was a good-looking guy. Don't get me wrong, and he probably was a good soldier, but he walked up and down laughing at us, you know, and he was telling us how worthless we was and stuff like that. And I thought to myself, one of these days a Russian's going to get to you, and then what are you going to holler and laugh about? He stuck out in my mind, and often wondered, I'll bet he didn't survive because he was one of them kind, you know, that you would shoot in a minute.
You could see it coming.
Yeah, if he wasn't a prisoner, of course you didn't shoot prisoners, but at least we didn't, I guess.
What was the moment for you where you really felt your freedom again, where you realized you were no longer a prisoner?
When we got up in the morning and we looked out and there was Americans in the gun towers. They had a white band on their left arm. The Germans had gone. That's when we knew we were safe. Now, we hadn't thought too much about the Russians, you know. We wondered about them a little bit, but we knew that was the time. Then this Russian colonel, they were going to leave the fences up until they flew us out, but this Russian colonel said, no, he said, take the fences down, go to town, and take what you want. Huh. So the guys, some of them come back with automobiles, and I knew a guy by the name of Bill Bensinger. He was from Ionia here. He was in that prison camp. He come back with a set of black horses on a hearse riding around. They made him take them back. Yeah. They belonged to the Burgermeister.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I understand that the journey after that and a little plane ride after you were liberated was just as hair-raising for you as anything leading up to it.
Oh, yeah. We were flown up to Camp Lucky Strike.
Right.
Now, they had named these camps after cigarettes. So, and here come a B-26, and it buzzed the camp. And I looked at the tail markings, and that was from my outfit. And I thought, gee, I got to see who that is. Well, when it landed and I walked up to the airplane, here come my original co-pilot. Mm. Brandy was his name. He said, well, come on. He says, we'll fly you back to Venlo. He says, we moved to Venlo. He says, we'll fly back there. And I said, I haven't got a pass. I can't go. Well, he went in and got me a 3-day pass. So we got in the airplane, and we started to fly back, and we hit the worst storm that I'd ever seen. And I thought, man, here we are up in raining, just pelting. And he hadn't looked down, and he'd seen a runway down there, and he went down through the clouds, and he landed that airplane, and in full blast. And he hit the brakes, and the brakes were squealing, and the airplane was shuddering, and we were coming toward the end of the runway, and I thought, yeah, here I am. I survived the war. I went to prison camp. I'm going to get killed in this airplane in peacetime, you know, but it stopped. And we got out, and we found out that we was at a mosquito outfit, the English mosquitoes.
Right, the bombers.
Well, yeah. We stayed there overnight, and the next morning it was nice. We took off and went back to the outfit and landed. And I seen all of my buddies. And Lieutenant Colonel Silk, he come up to me. Now, he was flying the airplane next to us on that mission. And that airplane, they got over Holland, and they all bailed out and let the airplane go, and it crash-landed in Holland. But they're the ones I thought was going down. Well, he and I were standing there talking. He was asking me questions. Some shapes tail lieutenant says, "Hey, you're talking to a colonel. You're not saying sir." And I'll never forget this. Soak says, "We're flying, comrades." He says, "You leave us alone." This guy that said that never had, he didn't have any wings on. He was just a shave tail, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I always admired Colonel Silk. He flew a lot of missions. He got married while he was over there. He married a nurse. Now he has passed away, and his wife is still living.
Well, and speaking of wives, you had a girl to get home to and try to talk her into marrying you if she would still have you. How did that all work out?
No, I didn't have to talk to her very hard. She was ready to get married, I think.
What was that reunion like?
I called my stepmother and said, "No, I'm going to be in Grand Rapids at a certain time in the morning, coming in on a train. I says, come over and pick me up." Now, that's about 35 miles from Ionia. So they come over and pick me up. Now, there was my sister and my stepmother and my wife, my girlfriend. That was a great reunion. Oh, that was great. Because it was just a few days before that they found out that I was alive.
Yeah, they had not even known. They received a telegram saying you were missing, where it refers to you in the past tense as if you're no longer living. And I imagine that you heard some stories about the rejoicing that occurred there when they found out you were alive.
The Army gave to my stepmother the addresses of the mothers of the other crew members. And now there were six of them. And these women all wrote to each other to see if anybody'd heard anything and stuff like that. And I wrote a book. Well, I sent you a copy of it.
Yes, sir.
And you see them letters in here. Now, these are what the other mothers wrote to my stepmother.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't know what was going on. Now, Sherry, who was our co-pilot, the bombardier, his wife had a baby while he was overseas, and he never seen that one. That makes you sad. You know, his wife writes and says, "Well, I don't know what happened to John. I pray for him and everything, and here he's dead." Like we three gunners got out, and the three officers up in front of the airplane. Yeah, the aircraft, the shells broke up in front of the airplane. One went right through the main right gas tank. And when I bailed out, there was gas pouring out of that. It's a wonder that didn't explode. I don't know why that shell, they said, went up ahead over the airplane and exploded above. But when it went through that wing, it's a wonder it didn't touch off that gasoline. The left engine was feathered. That means it was stopped, and they feathered the props so that they don't drag. And then Sherry and Turner were dead up there, so there must have been one exploded right near the cockpit. And Arnold, the pilot, he was mortally wounded. And he knew that, so he gave us orders to bail out. He didn't say, "Come up here and help me fly the airplane." He didn't say, "Come up and give me a hand." He said, "Bail out. And when they tell you to bail out, you go. You do what you're told."
And you didn't understand that all at the time. But
no,
now
not
that
at
you
the
do,
time, but I found it out later on.
And I'll tell you, it's choking me up a little bit just listening to you explain it that way. And I'm sure our listeners are experiencing the same thing, but it occurs to me that that's probably as fine an example of courage and selflessness that you've encountered.
Well, when we went out, I looked up in front, but there was nothing moving up there. You could see up through the airplane as far as you could see, you know, and there was nothing up there. We could see into the cockpit, but I could not see the pilot or the co-pilot. I seen between them, and I could see nothing up there, you know, so we got out. We was told to.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew that these airplanes, you know, airplanes were made to kill people. And they would kill Germans, they would kill Americans, they would kill Frenchmen, English, they killed anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen a lot of guys get killed in airplanes, and it wasn't good.
So when you think back on that now, and you see the life you've been able to live, that you got back, you married your sweetheart, you're still married almost 67 years later, the kids, the grandkids, the banjo, everything that you've experienced in life, and you realize that your pilot paid that price for you. It created that opportunity for you by allowing himself to die in that situation. What do you do with that? How grateful does that make you? And am I overstating it, or do you feel a real sense of gratitude?
No. The pilot kept that airplane flying level. He could have let it do anything, but he kept it flying level, and he crash-landed it. Then he died on the way to the hospital, so he was still alive. I think about him, and I've often thought, did I do wrong because we didn't try to get a medal for him, for his parents, for him? Mm. No, I wrote to his parents and explained it all to them, and they thanked me. Yeah, it still bothers me because he's buried down in Columbus, Ohio, and I was wondering if maybe someday I shouldn't take a ride down there and take him some flowers. I don't know where Sherry's at. I can't bring him up on the net. I'm going to try. And like I said, the people in Holland have put up a memorial. I was scouting around on the net a while ago, and I come up on the Sheboygan Redskin in that mission. And my name is in it. They wanted to know about it, so I wrote to them on the email.
Right.
But they still have not found Turner, and that I don't understand that. Turner was supposed to be buried right next to the airplane, along with Sherry, but nothing's been said about Sherry, so I don't know. I'm going to try to... I wrote to this guy in Holland, and I haven't heard back from him. It's been about 2 weeks now. Who knows? Another thing that I've seen was strange over there. You ever heard about that cathedral in Koblenz?
In Cologne.
Or Cologne, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that from the air. We flew by it one day, you know, and the anti-aircraft was much anti-aircraft around that thing. But there's another instance. I think God put a bubble around that cathedral. It never got damaged. It got some peck marks on it and stuff like that. But,
well, and wasn't the bridge adjacent to it completely destroyed?
Yeah. Yes, everything was destroyed around it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to explain it. It's like taking a house and putting it out in the middle of a field, and there's a house sitting there, and everything's flat around it. You could see that cathedral for miles, and Cologne was gone. But that cathedral sat there, and it was beautiful, and it made you feel good to know that it hadn't been damaged to a point to where it collapsed and stuff. Now, I was in some cathedrals, some big churches. We landed up at Toole one time because we were running out of gas. We landed at a fighter strip, and I went into town in Toole, and I went into a big church there that was half destroyed. Beautiful church. Great big church, you know, and made out of stone. The architecture was marvelous, all destroyed. It hurts you to see things like that. I'll tell you something. God has blessed me, has blessed my wife and my family, and I totally, totally believe that. And I've been humble ever since to that fact that we got out of that airplane alive.
Well, I don't think anyone listening today would argue or would fail to understand why you feel that way. And it's a powerful story that you've shared with us. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. Thank you very much for serving our country. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners today?
We was kids. I was 20 years old when all that was going on. And we did what we had to do, and if we had to do it, and we did. And that makes me proud to think of the men that I knew that stood up to the fact and beat the Germans. They were all kids, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, no, there's nothing more I want to say except God bless all the people listening, and I hope they have a good time. Thank you.
That is Lou Guernsey, 87 years old, of Ionia, Michigan. What a powerful story, and he tells it so well. You could tell that he's still pretty young at heart, has a lot of zest for life and a passion for playing that banjo. Well, it's been a pleasure visiting with Lou today. There was more to his story that we were not able to fit within the time constraints of the program, but you can listen to that bonus portion of the interview, if you will, at kmjnow.com in the Hometown Heroes podcast. Thanks for being here with us today. We'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.